Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time to take your calls. If you have questions about the Bible, about the Christian life, about the Christian faith, feel free to give me a call, or if you have a difference of opinion you'd like to express, feel free to call that in as well, as we can discuss anything like this that's on your mind. I received a letter from a listener, it must have been yesterday, and it's from a listener named David, and he says, Janice and I, must be his wife, I assume, he says, Janice and I have a family tradition of giving to various charitable efforts during the Christmas season in lieu of giving each other lavish gifts. We each make our donations separately, then reveal them to each other on Christmas morning. This year, I've chosen to direct my donations to several Christian radio ministries. I'm a frequent listener to Christian radio broadcasts. I've been making time to listen to The Narrow Path on KBRT as often as possible. I have learned from this so much, from the unbiased teaching of the Scriptures. Anyway, I just thought that was an interesting thing. A couple who, instead of giving each other gifts at Christmas time, they give gifts to charities and then reveal to each other on Christmas morning what gift was given, probably in the name of the other person, on their behalf. Anyway, we hope that you are prepared for Christmas and for the new year, and we just want you to know that some of the radio stations that we are on may not be hearing us in January, depending on support that comes in from those areas. And we've been we've been on the air for 14 years, but not on all of our present stations. And some of the stations, I know the economic news is not good, and I guess donations have gone down in some areas. But we just want to let you know that we hope to stay on into the coming year. We'll be giving you updates on that as the finances give us more information about that. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can check out our website, thenarrowpath.com, and there's information there about donating if you'd like. There's also lots of free resources there. You don't have to donate. You don't have to pay anything. They're all free. And you should check them out. It's thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk to Clyde from Portland, Oregon, first of all, today. Hi, Clyde. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I was reading recently an article on predictive prophecy and typological prophecy. And I know you've talked about types and anti-types in the past, but I don't recall you having addressed the issue of predictive prophecy in contrast with typological prophecy, and then also how that relates to the idea of double fulfillment. So I was just kind of wondering, I know you've talked some about prophecy recently, but you've kind of not really delved into the idea of predictive prophecy in contrast with typological prophecy. I just was wondering how you would relate those together, I guess, and then the issue of double fulfillment as a complicating factor.
Well, yeah. First of all, regular prophecy is just an utterance that says that something is going to happen. And, of course, that gives some basis for anticipation of it to happen. Typological prophecy is a little different. And for those who don't know, a type is something in the Old Testament that foreshadows or looks forward to something in the New Covenant. And we usually don't know what those are until afterward. That is to say, we don't know that a given story or a given thing or event or person is a type of Christ until after Christ came, and then we can see in retrospect. For example, it might be not surprising that David would be a type of Christ, since there's so many things said about the Messiah coming to be a son of David and like David and so forth. But we would not necessarily know which things in the story of David serve as a type of Christ until we actually look at the life of Christ and say, oh, I can see that now. This thing that happened in the life of Christ was foreshadowed in David's life. In other words, the types do not give an earlier generation reason to anticipate something, but it gives a later generation something to look back on and say, oh, there's a parallel here. We see, for example, in Matthew chapter 2, there are several different prophecies that are said to be fulfilled in the birth narrative of Jesus. One of them is a straightforward prediction from Micah 5:2, which is that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem, which he was. Then there's also one in there about how out of Egypt I've called my son, which is Hosea 11:1. Now, that's not really a prediction at all. In fact, it's a statement of the past. It's a reflection back on the fact that God brought Israel out of Egypt. That's in Hosea 11:1, at least it is. It's a reflection back on the Exodus. But Matthew sees the Exodus, that is Israel, being brought out of Egypt, as a type and a shadow of Christ coming out of Egypt in his infancy, because no doubt Matthew sees Israel as a type of Christ. And therefore what Israel has gone through is mirrored in what Christ has done. But you wouldn't have been able to predict that beforehand, because although you might assume that Israel would be a type of Christ, you wouldn't know which things in Israel's history would have parallels in the life of Christ. So when a type in the Old Testament has been fulfilled in the New, it's only in retrospect that we can recognize that this was so. Whereas a prophecy in the Old Testament that just predicts something outright can give reason to anticipate it. Now, you asked about double fulfillments, and sometimes people believe there are double fulfillments of prophecy. That is, a prophet will predict that something will happen, and it does happen. But then there's a secondary fulfillment that's still anticipated. And, you know, how does that fit into general treatment of prophecy? Well, I believe that when it comes to the general managing of prophecy in the Old Testament, we can only anticipate the first fulfillment of a thing. And a secondary fulfillment of it would be a little bit like a typological prophecy, in that the first fulfillment provides a type of another fulfillment later on. But we wouldn't know that until afterward. There are not very many prophecies in the Old Testament that we know of that have a double fulfillment. But, for example, in many of the prophets, there are references to God bringing Israel out of Babylon and bringing them back to their land. Now, he did that. That was the first fulfillment. But that provides a typological fulfillment, just like the Exodus from Egypt was a type of Christ and his salvation. So also the restoring of the Jews from Babylon is a type of God's saving his people through Christ. So when you see a prophecy that talks about the return of the Exodus from Babylon, many times it's merged together with prophecy about the Messiah. In fact, a person reading it in advance would not know that this has two different fulfillments. That is, part of it fulfilled in the return from the exile, and part of it fulfilled in a secondary sense.
Excuse me, Steve. Do you see double fulfillment as a possibility? I mean, is that a legitimate way to look at some of the prophecies, or do you need to break down the New Testament interpretations of the Old Testament strictly, either in predictive prophecy or typological prophecy?
Well, see, secondary fulfillments is it's not really a third category per se. It's just that in some cases a prophecy has a fulfillment, and then we are told that there's another fulfillment. So then there's a secondary fulfillment. Not all prophecy would have secondary fulfillment. In fact, we couldn't assume that any of them do, unless the New Testament tells us about that. In other words, we have a prophecy made in 2 Samuel chapter 7 about David's son who would reign after him and would build the house unto the Lord. And that's a reference to Solomon. Although it's beyond that, it's a reference to Jesus also. So even though Solomon was the first fulfillment of that, the New Testament tells us that that prophecy also has a fulfillment in Christ, which means there's a fulfillment in Solomon and a fulfillment in Christ. Although we could easily say that the fulfillment in Solomon was a type and a shadow of Christ. So there's a connection between typological prophecy and, a secondary fulfillment that would be foreshadowed in the type. This is perhaps a little more technical than the average listener may be able to follow very easily, but You have to kind of take prophecy on a case-by-case basis. And in my opinion, unless you've got the New Testament identifying the fulfillment of an Old Testament prophecy, you're really speculating whenever you suggest that there's a type or a secondary fulfillment of a prophecy.
Yeah, well, I guess what I found it really illuminating, though, to realize, like when Isaiah talks about the virgin birth, if you mm-hmm. see that as a typological prophecy, it makes it much more comprehensible rather mm-hmm. than as some sort of double fulfillment. Because if you kind of get into the idea of two peaks, you know, one peak in front of you and then another peak beyond you, a double fulfillment idea,
mm-hmm.
then it doesn't work out. But if you see it as typological, it makes it much more comprehensible when you see it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. And I don't have any objection to referring to a typological fulfillment as the second fulfillment or vice versa. When we talk about double fulfillment, to talk about one, the first is a type of the second.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think double fulfillment as an idea is kind of misleading or not totally valid to?
Well, it might not be a preferred way of speaking about the phenomenon. Maybe to talk about one thing as a type, the prophecy has a typological fulfillment and a final fulfillment.
Uh-huh.
In a sense, that's a double fulfillment. But
yeah.
It is in the nature of the case, there's a type and an antitype.
Yeah, right. Okay, that helps, Steve. I kind of might like if you, when you make references to prophecy, if you see one as a typological, it might help maybe me or maybe others to realize you're talking typologically on some prophecies.
Okay.
Hey, could I ask you, do you subscribe to Anagrass magazine?
I had a subscription, but when I moved last time, they lost my address, I think, so I don't get it regularly. Of course, I wrote something for the last issue.
Yeah,
and they sent me a copy of that.
Oh, they did. Huh?
Yeah, because they got my new address from me writing to them. Yeah.
Okay, but you're not getting a subscription right now, then?
No, not regularly. I wouldn't mind. I like their magazine. I just haven't. I don't get very many magazines.
Uh huh. Yeah. Well, I enjoyed your article in that latest. Actually, it was the issue before. Well, I mean, it is the latest. Yeah.
I think it was October, wasn't it?
Well, it was. They don't have a date on it. But
all right. Well, I've got a lot of calls waiting, Clyde. I'm going to run.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks for your call. Let's talk to Stephen from Seattle, Washington next. Stephen, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. My question is in Revelation chapter 12, verse 5.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what your opinion is on who the woman is that brought forth the man-child and who the man-child is and the time that this is supposed to be happening.
Okay. Well, the man-child, I believe, is Christ. The description of him seems to be intended to point us that out. It says she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. Okay, well, it is Christ who is to rule all nations with a rod of iron, according to Psalm 2 and verse 8 and 9. So this points to Christ. Now, the woman who bore him, we might think of her as Mary, and Roman Catholics do. They believe the woman who bore the man-child here is Mary. But I believe that the woman represents the remnant of Israel. Jesus was brought into the world through the remnant of Israel. And she is seen in the beginning of the prophecy as travailing to bring forth a child. And I think that travail speaks of the problems that Israel went through and the suffering they went through in the years before Jesus came to earth. But we see the dragon is waiting there to kill the child as soon as he's born, but he does not succeed. I think that refers to the fact that Herod, at the birth of Jesus, tried to kill Jesus and killed all those babies in Bethlehem in that attempt. When it says the child was caught up into heaven, yeah, to the throne of God, looks like we've dropped that call. I didn't drop it. Stephen must have hung up. I believe that the catching up to the throne of God is a reference to Christ's ascension into heaven and where he now sits at the right hand of God. And in support of this, we have verse 10, which says, "Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, 'Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down.'" Now, it says that the accuser of the brethren, that Satan, was cast down. It also says that salvation has come. Well, salvation came as a result of Jesus being dying and resurrecting and being caught up to heaven, which is the drama that is symbolically depicted prior to that. As far as the dragon being cast down, Jesus said this happened at the cross. In John chapter 12, I believe it's verse 30, Jesus said, "Now is the," or maybe 31, Jesus said, "Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the prince of this world be cast out." Meaning at the cross. At the cross, the prince of this world was going to be cast out. And that's what we read in the figurative language of Revelation 12, a dragon being cast out of heaven. And that represents Satan being cast out, I believe, at the cross. And so this is the drama of Jesus coming and redeeming us and defeating Satan at the cross. I believe that's what Revelation 12 is describing in those early verses. All right, well, we've lost our we've lost our caller there. Let's talk to Chris Ann in Spokane, Washington. Hi, Chris Ann. Good to hear from you again.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Good.
I was wondering what your thoughts on head coverings were.
Okay. Are you aware that I've written on that? And there's a lengthy article at the website on that subject.
No, I'm not.
Okay. Well, that, I'll just let you know that to begin with, because you know, it's a more full treatment. It's an examination of all the arguments for different positions and so forth. So if you go to the website, thenarrowpath.com, click on the link that says topical articles. And I think the name of the article is something like "Should Women Be Veiled" or something like that. It's very clear. And it's a thorough treatment of 1 Corinthians 11. Now, to give a little less thorough treatment here, I believe that the covering of women that Paul speaks of in 1 Corinthians 11 had a strong cultural component, because at the end of his discussion of it, he discusses it from verse 4 through verse 15 of 1 Corinthians 11. And in verse 16, after he's discussed it, he says, "If anyone seems to be contentious, we don't have any such custom, nor do the churches of Christ." In other words, he seems to be saying, well, okay, this custom I'm advocating here is not universal among the churches. It's, you know, it's not something to fight about. If somebody wants to fight about it, don't fight them about it, because it's not really a universal practice among Christians. Now, what practice is not? Well, what he's described is a woman giving an emblem, as it were, of her recognition of her husband's authority by her wearing a head covering when she prays and when she prophesies in the church. Mm-hmm. And and likewise, not cutting her hair. And Paul says on the flip side of that is that if a man covers his head when he prays or prophesies, or if he has long hair, that's a dishonor to him and to his head, Christ. Now, this is referring to worship behavior in Corinth, which was a Greek city, where women covered their heads and wore long hair, and men did not. Now, in other cultures, it was different, including the Jewish culture that Paul was from. And that's why Paul says, we don't have any such custom, neither do the churches of Christ. Paul himself took a Nazarite vow while he was in Corinth. In Acts 18:18, we read that he shaved his head at the end of a Nazarite vow. And that means he had been growing his hair during the vow, you know. And yet, when he writes to the Corinthians, he says it's a shame for a man to have long hair. But, of course, he means in that culture, it's a shame. But in his culture, it's not. In his culture, it may mean that you've taken a vow of holiness to the Lord. And likewise, you know, where Paul says to the Corinthians, it's a shame for a man to pray or prophesy with his head covered. Well, it certainly isn't that way in the Jewish culture. Men wear yarmulkes when they pray. And also, if one would say, well, wearing the yarmulke is, you know, that's a human custom, not a divine custom. Well, the divine commands given in Moses' day were that the high priest and the priests were supposed to wear a turban on their head when they worship. So for a man to cover his head while worshiping God was not forbidden in the Jewish culture. In fact, it was commanded that the priest must cover their heads. So we see that when Paul talks about a man not covering his head and a woman covering her head, he's not talking about a universal custom, certainly not one that was in Israel, and I don't think it was even in the Roman world. Because when Paul wrote to the Roman women, for example, in Ephesians, and in Timothy and Titus, Paul seemed to indicate that the women should be concerned about not having elaborate hairstyles, you know? And mm-hmm. why would that matter if their heads were covered? I mean, if their heads were covered, no one would see their hairstyles. So so that was a Roman, if that was to Ephesus, that's a Roman culture. Apparently the Romans and the Greeks had different cultures about this. But the Corinthians were Greeks, and so I think what Paul says to the Corinthians applies to their culture, and he gives the disclaimer at the end. But if anyone wants to be contentious, it's not a universal thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much. That's awesome, and I'll check out the article, too.
Okay, Chrisanne, good talking to you.
You too. Bye.
Bye now. Okay, our next call is from Joel in Las Vegas. Joel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Good.
Good. I gotta take the answer, your response off the air, okay?
Okay.
I believe correct me if I'm wrong, please do. I believe that you said that when Jesus prayed to have this cup passed from him, that he was praying to get out of going to the cross. I think that's what you said.
That's what it sounds like to me, yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought you said. Now, I like your answer today about predictive prophecy being fulfilled in the New Testament. In Isaiah 53, the prophecy is mentioned about Jesus being between two thieves on a cross, and it's fulfilled in Mark 16. So I can't understand where you're getting that from, but I'll have to take your answer off the air, brother.
Well, before you go, let me ask you, what do you think he was praying for?
I definitely believe he was praying for the ultimate separation from his Father not to happen when he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?
Right, but isn't that what his death was for?
His death, he came here, in my understanding of the Bible, he could have gotten out of the cross by praying to the Father and sending down more than 72,000 angels.
Right.
At any time, he could have come off of that cross. Those nails didn't hold him on that cross.
Right.
So I really believe that when he took upon all of our sins upon himself as a sin bearer, he knew that that separation would come. Because the Father couldn't look upon, the pure Father couldn't look upon those dreadful sins.
But when he said, let this cup pass from me, you're saying that the cup that he prayed would pass would specifically be his separation from God. Are you saying that he was praying that that wouldn't happen?
Yes, sir, I am.
But then why wouldn't that be the same thing as praying that he would not be crucified? His crucifixion would have no value if not for that separation, right?
I don't think so, Steve. He came here to die on the cross.
Well, yeah, but he came to die on the cross so that he could bear the sins of many, which is what we believe is the reason he was separated from his Father. In other words, if he had been spared that aspect, then he would have just died as a normal criminal on the cross, and his death would have been insignificant. It's hard for me to believe that he would pray that he would go ahead and go to the cross but have it be insignificant.
Well, I certainly know that you're more clever in wording things than I am, but see, in John 17, he shared the glory with the Father before the world ever began. And I'm not alone on this either, you know, Dr. Zacharias, Walter Martin, Dr. D.J. Kennedy, they all believe the same way. So it's not something that I've come up with on my own.
They believe that that Jesus was not praying to be spared the cross?
Dr. Zacharias got the book out called The Grand Weaver, and he tells you right in there that the ultimate separation and painful experience of Christ was his separation from the Father.
Oh, yeah. I don't think anyone disagrees with that.
Some people
might disagree with that, but I certainly don't disagree with that. No, what I'm saying is that I believe that when Jesus said, "Let this cup pass from me," the cup was the entire ordeal, which included being crucified and taking the sins of humanity upon him and experiencing separation from God. Now, I guess what I was trying to understand, it sounded like you were saying he wasn't trying to escape the ordeal of crucifixion. He just wanted to escape the part of it that would make it useful.
He didn't want to go through that separation from the Father.
Well, right. But are you saying that he wanted to be crucified but didn't want to be separated from his Father? I guess,
I'm saying that the thief on the cross got saved, so Jesus knew he was going to be up there.
Okay, well, I'm not quite gathering it. I understand what you're saying about the worst part of the ordeal,
well,
being separated from God. But it was the worst part. But it was part of it. You couldn't have one part of that ordeal without the whole thing, unless you just had Jesus crucified like any criminal, in which case his death would be of no value. What made his death of value was that he died as a sacrifice lamb and was cut off from the Father because he took on the sins of the world. So I guess what I'm saying is that's what he was sweating drops of blood about. Now, the cup, I think, that he was praying to be spared from, if possible, was the entire ordeal. And when Jesus was arrested and Peter drew a sword to try to defend him, he said, "Put away your sword. The cup that my Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" So he was. Peter wanted to defend him from crucifixion.
What he said, Steve, is that, do you not know I could pray to the Father? And
right, right. He did say that. Joel, he did say that. He also said what I quoted. He also said to Peter, "The cup that the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" Okay, yeah, I'm quoting from John, you're quoting from Luke, okay?
Well,
Jesus said,
I'm kind of shy because you're in the limelight of a lot of people, but at least, Steve, me and you agree, I think, from what you're saying, that that is the ultimate painful experience that you agree with me on, the separation from the Father that he always shared. So I'll take that, you know.
Okay. Okay, I appreciate your call.
You have a nice day, Steve.
Thank you, Joel. God bless you.
Okay.
I know. All right, you're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and you can reach me right here. There's lines open for you at 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090. Right now, a friend of mine wants to share something with you. I hope you'll stay tuned.
2,000 years ago, Pontius Pilate cynically asked the question, "What is truth?" Things sure have changed. The typical unbeliever today is not only unaware of the answer, but often has no inclination even to ask the question. Let me ask you a question. If truth did exist, would it matter to you? How much would it matter? Whom would you consult as an authority on the subject? Jesus said that God's word is truth, and the reasons for accepting this claim today remain far more substantial than any reasons given for rejecting it. In a 16-lecture series entitled The Authority of Scriptures, Steve Gregg not only thoroughly presents the case for the Bible's authority, but also explains specifically how this truth is to be applied to a believer's daily walk and outlook. The Authority of Scriptures, as well as hundreds of other stimulating lectures, can be downloaded in MP3 format without charge from our website, thenarrowpath.com. There's no charge for anything at thenarrowpath.com. Visit us there and be amazed at all you have been missing. That web address again is www.thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're taking your calls at 1-800-438-5090. 888-438-5090. Our next caller is Ron, calling from West Hills, California. Ron, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Hello, Ron. Okay, let me try that again. Okay, there we've got it. I'm sorry, your line was not activated. I thought it was.
Okay. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Yeah, I want to give just another perspective on the cup of that Jesus took in the sweating of blood.
Okay.
And as I see it, I think it says over in Hebrews, which of you has resisted sin unto blood? And when I see Jesus in the garden there and, you know, the agony, I don't think it was because he was going to be separated from the Father or even the fact that he was going to be crucified, because I don't think it was death he was fearing or what he was going through. I think it was the fact that he was holy. He was born holy. He was a whole, you know, and he had to become sin for us that we, you know, might become the righteousness of God in him. He had to take our sin upon him. And I think he was struggling with the fact that he had to become sin. And I think that was what made him even sweat blood, is not because of fear of anything else, but because he had to accept the sins of the world and become sin for us. And that made him to the point that he had to pray, Father, you know, if there's another way, you know, because he had to, the Holy One had to become sinful. He had to take sins upon him. And it was almost like he couldn't, you know, it was hard just to accept the sin. You know, we're sinful people. You know, we don't have that repulsion to sin that Jesus had. And I think that's what his whole struggle in the garden was, having to finally accept the cup of iniquity to the full and become sin for us. And from that point on, then he was a sin bearer. And I think it was his holiness that was causing him to sweat blood, not anything else.
Okay. Well, that's not very different than what Joel said. I mean, there's lots of aspects to the atonement, including Christ becoming the sin bearer, the Holy One becoming sin for us, his being separated from the Father judicially,
yes,
his suffering on the cross. I consider all those things to be part of the cup, but, I mean, yeah, that brings out another aspect of it.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Steve.
Good talking to you, Ron. Okay, Bill from Las Vegas, you're next. And we have a line open also at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Bill, welcome.
Hi, Pastor. It's about a month ago that you were talking about sex and procreation, and somebody called in about birth control. You had a long discussion with them. Do you recall that?
Well, it must have been a while ago now. I've had the conversation many times over the years. I don't know which conversation we had how recently.
I wanted to clarify what you said. I from what I understand of the conversation, you said that sex was for the purpose of procreation.
Sex was created for the purpose of procreation. That's what it was created for. It has other purposes, but that's what it was made for.
All right. Well, what about just pleasure?
Well, that's one of the other purposes, but it's not the primary purpose. The primary purpose was that man could not alone be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So God made a partner for him who was a sexual partner so that they could reproduce. I mean, certainly not wishing to take away from the value of pleasure in sex at all. I think we would have to just be realistic and realize how many organs of the female body that God designed separately from the male body, how many of them have to do with reproduction and how many of them have to do with sexual pleasure. It's like there's only one part that has to do with the pleasure, and there's a whole complex of machinery in there that have to do with reproduction. The pleasure, I believe, is a byproduct. I think it's icing on the cake. I believe very much like our taste buds are something God did to be kind to us. We had to eat to live. But if we didn't enjoy it, we might neglect it. So he made it enjoyable. He made it so that we enjoy the taste of food. I think people make a mistake when they think that food is primarily for pleasure. Well, there's certainly nothing wrong with enjoying your food. It's a very pleasurable thing to eat. But food is not primarily for pleasure. Food's primarily for nutrition. And when people divorce food eating from nutrition, they do things like bulimia. You know, they enjoy the food, then they want to vomit it up so they don't digest it, and then they want to eat it some more. And I think people can do the same thing reproductively. They can divorce it from its intended purpose.
Well, of course. But you were talking to a young man who was newly married at the time,
uh-huh.
and he had a question about contraception. And the way you presented it, it appeared to me that your position was that contraception was not a good idea, and that the pleasure of sex was to be discounted in favor of what you just talked about.
No, I've never discounted the pleasure of sex. I believe that couples that are too old to have children can still enjoy sex.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that couples that are barren can still enjoy sex. But that's to be recognized as not what sex was made for. Sex was made for reproduction. If there was no concern about reproduction, there's no reason to believe that sex would have been invented. As near as I can tell. Now, not to say that God doesn't want us to have pleasure, even when reproduction is not a possibility. It's possible. I don't think that God has any objection to you eating a candy bar, necessarily. Now, there's no nutrition in it, and it's all for pleasure.
I don't accept the analogy.
I do, because both of them are biological functions that God has made pleasurable.
Of course you accept it. It's your analogy.
Right. Well, why don't you accept it?
Well, because I've danced around this my entire life. I don't know how many times I've had the discussion, various doctrines in various churches about how sex is somehow less than wholesome.
That has nothing to do with this conversation.
Well, sure it does.
No, I've never said anything that sex is less than wholesome. Where are you getting that? It's not from me.
Well, you said it wasn't primarily, if sex wasn't primarily for pleasure. Well, then.
Right, exactly. What's that got to do with wholesomeness? I did not say anything about sex being less than wholesome. I believe sex is sacred. I think God made it to be the mirror image of the relationship between Christ and the church. I don't think there's anything more amazing that God made. But the point I'm making is... What?
Let me get the crux of my issue then. Why would you tell this young man that he shouldn't, his wife shouldn't be taking birth control? I don't understand... I don't understand how you can recommend that some other couple not take birth control.
Well, he didn't have to ask me if he didn't want to take my advice. If people ask my advice, I give them advice.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I didn't call him up and call him on the radio and say, listen, let me give you some advice about what you and your wife do. He called and asked me whether, it's advisable to use birth control. What I told him is this. I'll tell you again. I don't believe it's a sin to use birth control in itself. I can't think of why it would be. But I believe that many activities which are in themselves innocent or even good can be done for wrong motives. And if something is done with the wrong motive, it does become evil. So I'd be more interested in knowing why does somebody want to do it. Okay? That's what I want to know. So like someone could say, is it wrong to worship God? Well, it's wrong, too, if your heart's wrong, because the Bible says the sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination to God. But it's okay and good if your heart's right. So the question would be, if you're asking about birth control, is it good or bad, I'd say it depends on what your motives are. Why are you doing it? And I told him that the way I understand Scripture, children are a blessing from God. And the more that God gives you, the more blessed you are. The Bible says that. And so I believe that. Now, if a person doesn't believe that and they want to hinder God from giving them blessings, that's between them and God. But I'm not sure that's a good motive.
Well, that's why we've got hundreds of millions of children on the earth who are starving to death. Why we've got about a million of them coming up here from the south of our country every year.
Actually, that's not why. That's not at all why. The reason we have people... No. You're very naive. The reason there are people starving around the world is because of corrupt political systems.
It's like church.
What's
that? It has espoused the same thing you're saying for generations and not even allowed the rhythm method in their pronouncements from the pulpit. People who don't even have sex are trying to tell other people how to do it.
Excuse me a minute. I'm not here to defend the Roman Catholic priesthood and its celibacy. What I'm saying is it is not the fact that people trust God for their family size that causes starvation. You see, if the same people who trust God for family size also trust God for their provision, there's a promise of God that he will provide. Now, what causes starvation is corrupt political systems. And anyone who has paid attention to the way that charity is sent to African countries and other third world countries and does not get dispersed to the poor, but it's kept by the government officials and so forth, knows that this is true. And I'm surprised that you would not be aware of that. Okay, you're back on.
I'm back on.
Yeah.
So you're all done now? I can say what I was going to say?
No, you're done. Goodbye. You know, I think our listeners need to realize that I do get a chance to speak on this show. I'm the one who pays for the time on the radio, and I doubt that that caller has ever paid a penny to keep this program on the air. So I have the right, when you're talking over me, to put you on hold so I can say something. It was very generous of me to put you back on, but if I'm going to put you back on, you're going to scold me for talking. I'm sorry, this is a talk show. That's what I do, I talk. Let's talk to Brad from Kuski, Idaho. Hi, Brad, welcome.
Hey, my phone's got a big hum in it. Do you hear it?
I hear a hum, but I don't think it's any worse on your phone than what I've been hearing through the show.
Okay. Do you think that it's pretty probable that Christ was born sometime around December 25th?
No, I don't think it's very probable.
Okay. Just wondered.
Yeah.
When do you think he was born?
Well, I don't know if we have any indicators. It's possible, and this is just a long shot. I mean, no one should take this as a, you know, authoritative answer. But it is possible that the Feast of Tabernacles in September had its fulfillment in Christ tabernacling among us. The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. And if that's true, then it's possible that he was born around the Feast of the Tabernacles. On the other hand, if that presumption is true, he may have been instead conceived at the Feast of Tabernacles, since that's when he would begin to be tabernacled with us in a womb. So, he might have been born in September, or he might have been conceived in September, having him born sometime, I guess, in the summertime, or late spring. But either of those suggestions would be based on a connection between his incarnation and the Feast of Tabernacles, and that connection may not be a valid one.
Okay. I was going to make a quick comment about the last caller there, his idea. Right now, last weekend, there was a climate summit in South Africa. And these corrupt politicians, they don't want Africa to have electricity. They're starving because they're not allowed to develop. So I throw that in. And there's plenty of evidence to back up that statement I just made.
Yeah, corrupt government policies keeping people in poverty. Yeah.
Right, and this just happened this weekend in South Africa where they had this national climate conference, and they're claiming that the Earth is, you know, going to be destroyed if we let the developing world develop. You know, it's just a bunch of eugenics, really.
Yeah, well, yeah. There's a war against population, for sure.
Right, and it's a satanic war because Satan wants to kill people. So, if they can kill people by not letting them develop electricity, well, that accomplishes Satan's goal.
Yep.
Well, I'll let you go there.
Okay, Brad. Good talking to you, brother.
Bye.
Bye now. Okay, Stan from Las Vegas, you're next. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Yeah, the case made about sex being pleasurable, wouldn't it be the sex being pleasurable, therefore God wanted it to be pleasurable so people would have children? Couldn't it be said that if sex was something tedious or not pleasurable, that there would be less children born in the world? I don't know if the previous gentleman would agree with that. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I think it's absolutely true. In fact, I've got a feeling that if there's no pleasure in sex, that the population would just disappear in one generation.
But you don't think there'd be good religious couples of all faiths who would maybe go through the tedious process or the unpleasurable process, or whatever that might be, to have children?
Possibly. But even though people, even though people try to have children, they don't always have them. I think an awful lot of children are born that would not otherwise be born, probably.
Yeah.
Because people enjoy having relations.
It would be interesting whether the birth rates would go down by 50% or 75% if the act of sex was something that was tedious or not pleasurable. That would be a most fascinating study to do. But also on a corollary to that, what you said about food, evolutionists claim that, you know, we've evolved to eat food, obviously, to live. But isn't it true that we love the foods that frequently are the most dangerous and harmful to us and even that could kill us? So if evolution is true, why would evolution perfect a system that we crave or we want to eat things that are not good for us, and we really don't care that much to eat things that are very, very good for us? Would that be a good case for creation?
Well, that's an interesting, it may be a good case for the fall.
Okay. You mean before the fall, we only wanted to eat foods that were good for us. We didn't crave sugar, sweet things, hot fudge sundaes. I guess they didn't have hot fudge sundaes in Adam and Eve's time.
Well, they probably didn't. But, you know, I mean, it's interesting that as far as I know, other animals do not eat things that don't belong in their diet, you know.
Well, won't a dog eat cake and chocolate? It could kill him.
Well, yeah, a dog will eat it because the dogs have been domesticated by man and have developed a palate for human bad food.
Oh,
see, the
wow.
thing is,
okay.
You know, if in nature, if they don't have some kind of unhealthy food that man has developed, wild animals will not eat food that's bad for them, I don't think. You know, but people will. People will actually develop foods that are bad for them.
Okay, but would that be a case against evolution, that evolution would not have allowed this? In other words, if we keep going the way we're going, eating foods that are so bad for us, we're going to go extinct as a species with diabetes and cancer and heart disease.
Well, or at least we'll be an unhealthy species. I think that, you know, it makes a good case for creation and the fall, but I don't think it makes an airtight case because the evolutionists could claim that, you know, evolution played its role up until a rational creature with free choice came along who had the ability to make really bad choices. And, you know, that the bad choices we make are not necessarily the product of evolution, but simply the fact that we have evolved rational powers are the result of evolution, I think they'd probably say. And then of course, the bad choices are our own, not evolution.
Okay, so you think after the fall is not after the Noah's flood, where we started eating maybe bad foods. It was after the fall, and up until Noah's flood, we were eating properly.
Well, I don't say when we began to eat improperly. I'm saying that if we were not fallen, we probably would not be drawn to things that are bad for us.
Oh, that's a fascinating case. It combines science, theology, common sense. I'm going to look further into that. And I'll let you get to your next caller. Thank you very much.
Okay, Stan. Good talking to you. Bye now. Let's talk to Roger from Salinas, California next. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Good afternoon, Steve. And thank you for your show.
You sound kind of far away. Are you talking through a speakerphone?
Yes, I am. Let me. Is that better?
It is better. It's louder, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So my question is on John 6, verse 37. It says, you know that one, right?
Well, it's a Calvinist text.
It's a Calvinist text?
Yeah, I believe it is. Let me see. Let me look it up here. I just recognized the John 6 and 30-something. Let me see what verse 37 is.
So it's in the Bible for a reason,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, all that the Father gives me will come to me, right? And the one who comes to me will by no means cast out, right? That's a Calvinist text. I mean, it's a text that Calvinists use, yeah.
But that does mean that there is certain people that God has entrusted to Jesus Christ, to Messiah, to follow. You know, maybe Jesus Christ intervenes a lot more with these certain people. But he's saying that other people who are welcome to come are welcome. Whoever hears about him are welcome. Or is it talking about the Jewish people?
It's talking about the remnant of Israel who were hearing him speak. They were already, before Jesus came, they were already God's people because they had become faithful to God on God's earlier terms.
So, like,
and when Jesus came, God transferred them to him. That's what Jesus said in John 17:6. In John 17:6, he's praying. He says, I have manifested your name to the men whom you have given me.
Yes.
He says, out of the world. They were yours, but you gave them to me. Now, in other words, the people that God gave to Jesus are the ones who were already God's people. He says, they were yours, and you gave them to me. He does not say they were the devil's people, and you gave them to me.
Yeah, of course.
They were already God's people. So the people that Jesus speaks of as being as the Father giving him are the ones that were already God's people before Jesus came.
Jewish people
who were faithful to the covenant.
Awesome.
And who came to the Messiah.
Awesome. Okay, perfect. That makes sense.
Okay,
so
Roger.
He's saying that the rest, you know, he keeps on going and saying that, and the ones who come, you know, are welcome, right? But
exactly. I will by no means cast out, right?
Sure.
So anyone who comes to Christ, he will receive. He won't cast them out.
Yeah, okay. Perfect, man. That's lovely. Steve, you're awesome, bro. Keep doing what you're doing.
Well, I appreciate your call, brother.
I appreciate all your knowledge, man. Good stuff.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks.
Bye now. All right. Well, we only have a minute or two or three left. We could possibly get one more call in, but our lines are just cleared. If you want to be on the program, you might have like 30 seconds or a minute for the last word. The number is 1-800-438-5090. Edgar wrote to me and said, I've been trying to pick up your ideas about the security of the believer from listening to your program several times. It sounds like you do not believe in it. Where do you stand on this? From Edgar. Well, some people say the security of the believer when they mean eternal security, and by which they mean once saved, always saved. Now, if someone says, you know, once you're saved, you can never drift away from God or cast off your salvation, I have to disagree with them. I believe you can do that. I do believe in the security of the believer, though, because whoever believes in him is saved. And so as long as you're a believer, you are secure. Now, if you cease to be a believer, well, the Bible doesn't teach the security of the former believer. You have to be a believer. A believer is someone who believes. And if you don't believe, then you're not a believer. So if you used to be a believer, but you're not now, well, you're not one. Anyway, Lisa from Carmel, we only have about a minute. Do you want to have the last word?
Hi, Steve. Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
Just really quickly back to the earlier call regarding Jesus crying out at this cup.
Yes.
Taken. Jesus knows God more intimately than any of us ever could, and we serve a humongous God. So I imagine that Jesus hanging there, taking it for us, he was not about to get off that cross, but that he was saying, Father, if there's any work around here, because you're a mighty God, if we can do this thing, if you can succeed in taking away the punishment and putting the sin on me without me having to go through that separation from you, please do it. And of course, as you would say, and we all agree, and God proved, that was not possible. He had to bear that sin.
I appreciate your call. I'm sorry I'm out of time, but I let you have the last word there. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to find out more about keeping us on the air, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Or you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow so we can continue our discussion. God bless you.